Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. This is your host, Sean Lee, and welcome to episode 42 of The Vampire Squid. Today we have on a very special guest, Jacob Mullins from Shasta Ventures. And Jacob has a very entrepreneurial background. In today's episode, we talk about his starting a consumer products good company that used plants from South Africa. We talk about his being the second employee of VentureBeat, one of the most prominent technology blogs. And we also talk about his founding of ExitRound, which is a marketplace for M&A transactions. As always, if you guys have any questions, comments, suggestions, please feel free to visit me at Alan, A-L-A-N, at thevampiresquid.com. And you can always visit my Facebook page, facebook.com/thevampiresquid. Today we have on a very special guest, Jacob Mullins from Shasta Ventures. Jacob, thanks so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Great. So if you wouldn't mind, could you give a brief background on, you know, where you were born, where you went to school, and, you know, how you ended up at Shasta?
Absolutely. So I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I was going to high school during the late 90s. In the era of the tech boom, of the first tech boom, I guess. So that was kind of a trial by fire, and which helped shape a lot of kind of my career path since then. Mm-hmm. I went to college at Yale, and I majored in political science there, and then have been back in the Bay Area ever since, for the past almost 15 years working on different startup things in the startup world from many different perspectives, from the startup side to the venture capital side.
Yeah, and I know you had a bit of an entrepreneurial background even since you were pretty young. Could you briefly talk on that?
Absolutely. So, you know, growing up in the late 90s in the Bay Area, some of my family members were in tech at that time. And so in high school, I was interning at tech companies and kind of seeing, you know, two things. One, the ability to exert tremendous amount of change on different businesses or industries or people through technology. And then two, the incredible wealth creation ability of technology. And that kind of just stuck with me as I went to college. And so in college, my best friend and I started a company. We wanted to be entrepreneurs, and, you know, it took us a couple of years to figure out what we wanted to do. And sooner than later, we ended up starting a company that was kind of strange, but it was a dietary supplement company that manufactured plants from South Africa, which were a natural nutraceutical product. And we manufactured those into consumer packaged goods. So a gum, a drink, and a supplement, and then sold those online. And we sold them in stores, and we sold them via infomercials, so primarily direct. So it was kind of my earliest forays, and we did that for about 4 years, 2 years in college, 2 years after college, and then...
How does that idea even start? I don't even know when I would come up with some type of nutritious plant from, you know, South Africa to sell to others.
It's a great question. You know, we were being driven again by the entrepreneur bug, and we wanted to jump in, and my best friend was actually watching the news one night and saw that Pfizer was synthesizing this particular plant in order to create a pharmaceutical product from it. And we, for whatever reason, we thought that we could come to market faster with a supplement product, an unregulated, you know, functional food or supplement product, before they could come to market with a pharmaceutical, given FDA testing. We didn't have any particular expertise in the space. We just had that insight, and that led to 4 years of building a company. At the largest, it was, you know, we were doing a couple million in revenue, and we had 40 acres of this plant growing in South Africa, and we were traveling often there. And so it really was kind of trial by fire, building a completely vertical business, everything from planting the plant to harvesting, processing, manufacturing, you know, marketing, and distributing. It was a lot for a three-person company, I'll tell you that.
So great. So you were doing this plant, and you were selling these products in the CPG industry. What do you think were some of the major challenges of doing that, you know, since it's
grown in South Africa, I can imagine the logistics and the supply issue might have been quite difficult to manage.
Yeah, the there are a number of challenges being completely vertically integrated. It didn't let us focus on one particular piece of the puzzle, which may have been marketing, which may have been distribution or, you know, supply, or locking up supply. So I think the most difficult part was just being stretched in so many different directions as a capital constrained company. But second to that, it was getting on. I mean, it was marketing in that space. The consumer packaged goods space and the supplement space is one of the most fought for spaces. AdWords are the most expensive, and you know, it's you're also plagued by a number of manufacturers who enter the space because there's a trend or a hot product, and then flood the market with a bunch of product that's not real. It doesn't have any of the actual ingredient in it, and they sell it under your cost, and so they cut you out and just flood the market with a bunch of it. So it dilutes the brand perspective of the product itself. So there's a lot of challenges in there. Those are just a couple, but it was a great learning experience. I mean, in order to capitalize that company, we did a reverse merger into a public shell, which was an awful idea after the fact. And I think everybody around us at the time and you know, even now, everybody kind of does a collective moan and a collective oh no that you did that. And
you did a reverse merger into a public shell, so your company was public.
Yes, so we had a publicly traded company.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a week after I graduated college, we did the reverse merger, so we ended up with a public company. I mean, it was a three-person company, but it was public. and it was a way that we raised money because venture capital in that market in that time just was not the right way to capitalize. There wasn't a lot of interest. And, you know, this was a way to essentially provide liquidity to us, bring in some friends and family, and then kind of float it for the longer term.
And in was short, this in early 2000s or?
It was 2005.
Got it.
Yeah, 2005. So it was public for about 2 years, and then we ended up bringing it back private. But what an experience.
Yeah, that sounds that definitely sounds fascinating. So with that, you know, what did you do afterwards?
Kind of is that, you know, that market, as I mentioned, that products in that market tend to have a natural life cycle. And as the hype and trend kind of dies down, so does the demand. And at that point, I kind of looked up and said, you know, hey, I've been doing dietary supplements and infomercials. How the heck did I get here? And so then, you know, having grown up in the Bay Area and kind of told you my earlier experience, I said, well, let's get back into tech. And was just looking around at a number of opportunities to do that. And it was the early days of the transformation in media with blogging and kind of independent publishing that was on the rise. So I joined a small but burgeoning tech blog called VentureBeat, which now is a, you know, it's a mainstay for venture capital and startup news. I was the first business guy there, so I was focused entirely on revenue generation, you know, managing a lot of the capital raising and basically just, you know, letting the writers write, and I managed the rest of the business. So it was a good experience, a good way to get to learn and meet people in early stage tech, and was there for about a year. And then personally, I wanted to understand how larger companies were able to work and be efficient and push multiple projects and initiatives forward. So I joined Microsoft, though based in San Francisco, and Microsoft was just about to launch a startup program, a startup focused program called, and so I joined there, and it was a great experience, great way to meet startups and kind of be in a corp dev role. And was there for a couple of years. And then I joined Shasta Ventures, actually the first time, Shasta twice. And I joined as a senior associate then, and was mainly looking at consumer and mobile deals. So that was around the year 2000. And at my prior company, what I'd done is I built, or with a team, but we built a piece of software that helped identify high potential startups out of a mass of around 45,000 companies in the program. Yep. And so that kind of technology filtering was unique and kind of a differentiator for me as I was looking at going into venture capital.
This was exit round, right?
No, that was actually joining at that was being at Shasta the first time. Then I left Shasta and I started Exit Round. Essentially at Shasta, I was able to see how companies were, how the M&A process was actually run. A common misconception in Silicon Valley is that, you read the tech press and you read about all these M&A deals happening and you just imagine a truck backing up and pouring a bunch of money on everybody and it's just this rosy day. And, in reality, it's very different. So having the opportunity to be in the boardroom and think about it from an investor perspective gave me a lot of insight. And the insight was for M&A was that, one, M&A is a much more proactive process than typically entrepreneurs think. Two, it is commonly, conducted within a small network of people, people that already know each other. And three, there's just a tremendous amount of intransparency. And so you miss potential opportunities because of that intransparency. There's misconnections for buyers and sellers all over the place. And so our perspective for Exit Round was, why don't we create a marketplace, a network of sorts, where you can keep confidentiality and privacy high, but you can use recommendation technology and structured data to help identify more relevant buyers or sellers, depending on what side of the equation you are on. So said in other terms, we essentially created a dating site for buyers to find sellers and sellers to find buyers based on the characteristics of each of their company. So, super interesting company, actually still going. My co-founders are continuing that. It's, very active data service that there's over 20,000 buyers and, 5,000 active sellers. So it's an actively used service within Silicon Valley. But, it's very much a transaction model, which was not the model we originally thought we were building. So we can talk about that later. But just to kind of finish up my career path, about a year ago, I transitioned out of there and out of Exit Round. And now rejoined Shasta Ventures in the fall, focused on emerging platforms and specifically virtual reality as well.
Got it. Yeah, and I think with Exit Round, I was looking a little bit into it. I think it's a great idea because of all the M&A, I think usually investment banks or other facilitators cover most of the larger M&A deals, but for the small and medium-sized businesses, for the ones that they want to sell to from a seller and a buyer standpoint, the transparency and the network is fairly limited in terms of who you know. So having this platform greatly increases that outreach.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Our focus was on, we call it the long tail of M&A. But, by the numbers in early stage tech, 88% of transactions happen under $100 million. And so, for a transaction says under $100 million, that's not a particularly a transaction that's interesting to the large banks or even a boutique bank for that matter. Yeah. So what happens to that, to the ones that are in the 50, 25, 10, $5 million range? Where, by the way, those deals of that size can actually be meaningful for the founders and the team and the employees, as well as the investors can get their return on investment. So they're not bad deals; they're just small deals, and bankers typically don't focus on that. So that's the space we were servicing.
Yeah, and I think the business model you guys went with was 1% of the transaction value, or X dollars if it's an acquihire. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The greater of. And, I think what we've learned from that is it's two things. One is we were essentially, with given that model, here's an analogy. We would be Match.com, but we would only get paid if people got married. And while that's a great success for a transaction, it's actually not compensating the business for the value that it's providing. The value that the business is providing is actually surfacing potential options on both sides, providing data and connections for both sides. And with a business model that was so transaction focused, we it was just off. It was a missed assumption. The second was the, you know, that M&A is just so, so emotional and personal based. You know, especially at these levels of M&A that ExoRound's dealing with. You know, if you're dealing with private equity transactions or large companies with significant revenue or growth or objective metrics, you know, you can put a relative value on it, on a transaction. But with ExoRound, because of the segment of the market we were focusing on purposely, by the way, it was far more, you know, emotional based between buyer and seller. Does the seller want to get acquired? Does it want to work there? Did they, you know, have good meetings with these people? And emotions are important in M&A, no matter how big or how small. But in this case, when there's very little value other than the people, it really is an unfair judge of kind of the only business model that the company had. So, we've rejiggered a lot in that. And the third part is that collecting fees after the fact, when you're not banking, physically banking the transaction, is nearly impossible. You know, ExitRound's main focus was to connect buyers and sellers, but do it in a hands-off fashion. So just like a software network connects people, we don't get involved in the transaction. But that meant we would get left out of the transaction and information of even what state it was in. So we'd have to collect fees afterwards. So for all of those reasons, the company in kind of its newer form, we've totally shifted. And now it's a software. It's a piece of software that provides the same information for buyers and sellers to find each other. However, it's just charged on a flat monthly basis. It's $100 a month. Use it as much as you like and off you go. So, businesses evolve and as do models.
That answers my next question, because I was thinking, you know, what's to stop the buyer and the seller from, you know, just going off and then, you know, negotiating the contract or the acquisition off the platform and, you know, not paying you guys. But I think that makes more sense than using the flat fee.
I'd say, you know, I mean, we captured a lot of transactions and, you know, they all signed legal agreements that said they'd pay us in those instances. But there were also a lot of transactions that did not self-report, and then we'd have to go around after the fact. And that was just a huge pain.
Yeah. And did the platform also provide the data room and to store files and stuff, or was that offline? Or
we had the functionality. We actually launched with Box on their platform as they launched a fintech product. And so, yes, we had it. It was just not used, far, far underused. And it's because, again, we weren't – the way we're positioning ourselves and kind of where we were sitting in the transaction was not the workflow of the space. It was just the finding of the buyers and the sellers. Essentially, like, the banker brings in the logo slide with all those logos. We were bringing more interesting logos that nobody had ever thought about that were actually quite relevant.
I remember those slides fondly.
Yeah, exactly. And like, so actually now there's a number of bankers that pay for our service just so they can use the data to be able to populate their own logo slides with better ideas than the next guy. So, you know, the evolution of a startup.
Cool. And talk a little bit more about VentureBeat. And I know VentureBeat is, you know, one of the most prevalent tech blogs or tech news sources out there, and they break quite a bit of transactions. And what was it like when you were working there? You said it was fairly small, and it was 2007 or?
Yeah, it was 2007. It was two writers, Matt Marshall, who started it, and Eric Eldon, who later became this TechCrunch or the editor in chief of TechCrunch, so switched flags. And it was me. So
you were the fourth employee?
I was technically the second employee. So it was Matt, Eric was the first, and then it was me. Technically second. Yeah, I mean, not even technically, just actually second employee.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It was, you know, that was like the heyday of blogging. TechCrunch had just started 6 months before. Mm-hmm. All the big ad networks were just starting to grow. Federated Media, Glam Media, Millennial Media, all these. Everybody thought these ad networks were, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. Meanwhile, you know, it was an interesting place to be sitting in the industry from a strategic and kind of career point of view, because at these blogs, you know, every startup wanted to get the blog's attention so they could launch their products, because that you know, in those days, there was not a lot of blogs. So if you got the attention of one of these big tech blogs, you'd get a ton of new users. You'd generate a lot of interest from venture capital firms. So it was the hot ticket. And same for large platform companies would also, and tech companies would want to get our attention to launch products for the similar reasons. So, you know, not being a writer there, but still being affiliated with it was really helpful, because I'd be able to open doors throughout Silicon Valley, companies large and small, and meet them. And, you know, for partnership reasons, for business development, for I tried to sell them things. I was trying to sell things to everybody. I was selling sponsorships to venture capital firms and, you know, event packages. We even did one, the most interesting, I don't know if I'd call it interesting, but the most unique ad sell that we placed was like an audio blogging segment. It was actually what a podcast would be today. It's like a micro podcast.
Huh.
And a large tech computer manufacturer built it or bought it. And once a week, one of our writers for like six months would have to basically record themselves talking about a trend for, you know, 6 minutes and then upload it. And so it was this audio posting. Now that actually sounds quite normal considering what we're doing right now. But
for this advertising segment, so a company would record basically a podcast and you would play that on your site. Is that how it works?
No. We'd essentially write a story, but instead of writing the story, we would dictate the story, or we would basically podcast a tech blog story and then put that podcast in the flow of content. You know what I'm saying?
Put it in the flow of content. That means?
That means, you know, when you like scroll down a page, there's like story one, story three. This would be like story one, story two, audio post, story three, story four, audio post. So there was just like an odd random audio post in the flow.
And you would sell ads on that audio file too. So they would do a
pre-roll
ad.
Exactly.
And you would say, this is brought to you by X company.
Precisely. Yeah. It was so funny. So that was, and our writer hated it. I literally would have to like hold them down on Friday night to like record this before we left for the week, because we had to hit, you know, one a week to keep the deal. Oh man, that's so funny. But you know, that such is the early days of a company. Again, I mean, what I've learned from that is conference business. You know, media is a great generator of conference businesses. Conference businesses can be very successful. They're a lot of work, but they can be very successful in building out a brand. So, you know, it was a fun time to be in that industry, but I'm glad to not be in it anymore. As are many of the writers who used to be there. A lot of them have transitioned out. You know, as it's become more commoditized, the, you know, salaries and pricing and everything, web advertising has gone down. And so there's just not a lot of money in it, despite its importance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Because I see with some of the ones that are popping up nowadays, like I think one of them is like the information. They just have the paywalls. And I don't know how successful those are. I mean, the Wall Street Journal has it. Forbes, I don't know if Forbes has it. But Wall Street Journal definitely has it. And they must be doing well with it.
I think they do pretty well with it. The information, I believe, has close to 1 million paying subscribers.
Oh, wow.
So thanks for listening to part one of the interview with Jacob Mullins. And I think part two is even more interesting as we dive into emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, and we get some of Jacob's thoughts on these emerging technology trends. So stay tuned for next week, and I look forward to hearing you guys soon. Ciao.